I hope you realize what a remarkable destiny you have because you are a human being, and what remarkable capacities you have because you are a human being. Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, in the 6th chapter of Matthew, as it's recorded, gives us this exhortation in verse 19. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on the earth, where moth and rust consume and thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust consumes and where thieves do not break through and steal. You have a choice. Here we are as human beings, located somewhere between the animals that walk about on all fours and angels. Animals that are of the material world entirely, and angels that are of the spiritual world entirely. But you and I are amphibians. We inhabit both worlds. We were made from the dust of the ground, and then God breathed into our nostrils the breath of life, and we became living souls. I'm not sure that that statement in Genesis has reference to the spiritual quality of man, but the truth is that when God put upon us the impress of his own nature, we received a spiritual dimension. And therefore, Jesus had to say to us, don't put your money in the physical bank. Don't invest your life in physical things, but rather invest your life and what you have in the world of the Spirit. How do we escape the grip of materialism? This is so real. And our bodies are so real. And they have an immediate kind of tug and pull on us. And it is easier, I think, by far, just to invest ourselves in responding to whatever the physical man has an interest in. To do otherwise, it seems clear to say, requires some serious thought. I hope I am not speaking condescendingly when I just say this to you. If you are simply living your life in response to that physical part of yourself, that you're not using too much of your brain. To see that which cannot be seen requires thought. Doesn't take too much thought to feel your way through life and respond to these physical impulses. To see a world that is tangible. And when you say to somebody else, do you see that car? Well, they can look and see that car. You see this house, they can look and see that house. You see this money, they can look and see this money. It doesn't take any effort on your part to convince them that the physical world is real. And most of the world thinks at that level. So the world doesn't just mean the physical manifestation of the creation, but it means an attitude and a set of values that says, this is what life is about. And so we call it not only worldliness, but we could also call it the current culture. How people look at life and how people look at things. How do we escape from that? I mean, it's like walking through one of these enchanted forests or haunted forests. And I've seen those cartoons where all the leaves of the tree are reaching for you. And everything about you is trying to get hold of you. And that's sometimes how it is with us. We live this evening in two different worlds. The world that we sleep in and marry in is real, tangible, and easily perceived. But we also live in a world of the Spirit. Ecclesiastes 12:7. The body returns to the dust from which it came, but the Spirit returns to God who gave it. Its habitation is with Him. God is Spirit. And the Spirit returns to God who is the Father of our spirits, as Hebrews 12 says. Romans 1:20 says that the invisible things of Him, nonetheless, are clearly seen. Interesting kind of language. The invisible, the unseen things are clearly seen. Being perceived, he said, by the things that have been made, even his everlasting power and deity. But I want to tell you, you're not going to get this vision of the reality of God if you don't really try. Because the pressure of the world that is so visible and so substantial as it responds to our senses will overpower you. And you'll find yourself just totally responding to that sort of concern. Every time there's a decision to be made, then you'll make it in terms of this physical world and the physical part of it. The truth is that when you please God, you've got to do two things. You've got to see two invisible things, two unseen things. That's what Hebrews 11 says. That those who come to God must believe that He is. Now, I want to tell you something. You believe in the unseen when you believe in God. You can't see Him with the physical eye. So it takes the mind and the heart to perceive the obvious truth that we didn't get here by ourselves, and that there is a part of us which is not explained as the product of physical things. Proverbs 20 and verse 27. The spirit of man is the lamp of the Lord, searching all his inward parts. There is a part of us that cannot be explained by medicine, that is not physically apprehended, a part that will not appear to the surgeon's knife, will not yield to the test of the physician. And we know that. A man who has never seen the world in which he lives has touched it. But he has also touched God by using the mind that God has given him to see that there is a part of us that has reality that is unseen. And that part of us is what God has put inside of us, that is conscience, that is a concern for right and wrong, that gives us a sense of guilt that gnaws at us, that causes us to be warned when the choice is before us to do what we judge to be wrong, and we feel a sense of foreboding. And if we listen to it, we will escape that temptation. But if we do not listen to it, we will do it, and if we do it, we will feel the remorse and the pain that comes. Now that is the lamp of the Lord in us, the Spirit. In fact, when I think about this citizenship in two worlds, I think this, the world that is easiest for us to perceive, this physical world, we see with our eyes open. But I think if you want to see the other world, you have to shut your eyes. And think, and consider, and weigh. Now, there's one thing about this physical world that is pretty apparent. The Lord speaks about that. He said it doesn't last. Thieves can steal it, and moth and rust can consume it. So, just get ready. You can't build your life on this present world. But we know all that. We know all that. Death, sickness, dying. Things taken away from you that you cherish. Things that you thought would be absolutely all you'd ever want. And you got it, and it doesn't even mean a thing to you anymore. Especially when certain crises come and the physical world looks like it's about to depart from you from it. and then suddenly we get some insights into what really is valuable. Then we begin to see the invisible world. And Jesus said, that is where we need to put our treasure. He didn't say split it between the two. You talk to any good financial counselor and he'll tell you to have a balanced account. You mustn't put all your eggs in one basket. You put some of your money over here and some of your money here and some money over here, because if one part of it fails, you'll have some others that will not. It's just hedging your bets. But in this case, Jesus does not say, you better put a little money in this invisible basket over here, because it just might turn out to be so. But you ought to have a little money over here in the physical basket, because after all, what if this is not so? And you don't want to miss out on this. He doesn't say that. He said, lay up your treasures in heaven, period. Because the other is going to be lost. It's not a question of this will be good and that will be good. It's a question of survival here. And the spiritual man is the man who must be fed. The spiritual man is the one who must direct the affairs of your life. And that's the choice you make. It's up to you. If you want to believe that God is, and that second impossible thing that I got sidetracked and didn't mention is, and that he's the reward of them that diligently seek him. You haven't seen either one of those things. You haven't seen God, and you haven't seen the reward yet, have you? Well, you say, I've tasted some of it. I've got some experience of it, and I know that's true. But ultimately, the reward that comes to the man that God has created in his own image, that really satisfies the wholeness of his being, you haven't seen it yet. You have to have faith to see God. All of which means takes effort, takes thought, take serious consideration. Not just a response like some animal to an urge. Not just a blind response to some stimulus. That's what an animal does. And we're not mere animals. And consequently, we need to come to grips with it. We need to see the invisible, in short. 2 Corinthians 4:18. We look not upon the things that are seen, for the things that are seen are temporal. But the things that are not seen are eternal. Isn't that strange? That the things that seem so real, the things that we can see, they're the things that are going to go. But the things that we cannot see and therefore can seem so insubstantial, and we reach out for them, we can't touch them with our hands or see them with our eyes or hear them with our ears, taste them with our tongue. We can't do any of those things, and yet this thing that seems so insubstantial to the physical man is at last, in the final analysis, the most substantial thing there is. And the reason it is substantial is because in deeper than our being, we have a spiritual quality. And we need to let it grow and exercise its influence on our lives, because the things that we can see pass away. But the things we cannot see, those are the things that never pass away. Hebrews 11:27. You remember what the writer of Hebrews said about Moses? In all his trials and difficulties, making his decisions about Egypt or Israel, pleasure or suffering, what do you do about this? The physical body saying pleasure is obviously the safest course here, and at least certainly the appealing one. And playing it safe and not getting into the hands of the Pharaoh, that's obviously good sense, and you ought to do that. But there was something else in Moses, and that thing is in you. And he made the right decision, and this says he endured as seeing him. Here's that strange combination of terms again. He endured as seeing him who is invisible. How do you do that? By faith. That whole chapter is about faith. Interesting thing. We're capable of that. Human beings can reason themselves from evidence given to the existence of things that they cannot see, and that can become more real to them than what they can see. You say, that's blindness. No, that's sight. That's facing the reality of our own nature. It's facing the reality of our own needs. And we're here tonight so we can together. Stir each other up again to see invisible things. 2 Kings chapter 6. Interesting story about Elisha, who was giving trouble to the king of Syria because the king of Syria was attacking by raids the nation of Israel. And he had set his army in a certain place. And every time he would get ready to trap the Israelites, they wouldn't come back. I mean, he had the snare set. And he was certain he had them. And they wouldn't even show up there. And finally, his counselor said, "Don't you know? Elisha is telling the king of Israel everything you say in every discussion of counsel you have. He's letting them know." Well, they decided to take care of Elisha. Elisha, an interesting fellow. Fifth chapter, you know, he could have been wealthy. And after all, the physical man thinks about all that. But Elisha didn't seem to have very much, and not only that, Elisha didn't care. And yet he's giving counsel to kings. He's giving a counsel to Jehoram, the king of Israel. He didn't have much respect for him, as is evidenced in chapter 3, when Jehoshaphat and Jehoram wanted him to give them counsel about what's going to happen to them. They'd gone out to battle against Moab. It looked like they were in a very hard place, didn't know what to do. And he came and said, I wouldn't give you the time of day, if I may paraphrase Jehoram, but because Jehoshaphat is here, I'll help you out." He was concerned about the people of Israel. But when the time came, after this great soldier came from Syria, and that's an interesting story because Syria is the great enemy of Israel during this period. But Naaman came because he was a leper. And he'd been instructed by this little girl who didn't care about things either, because she just cared about people. And the fact that this man was her slave master, the fact that she'd been stolen away from her family by the Syrians, and now she's a handmaid in the house of Naaman, didn't bother her. She just concerned about people. And so she told him about this great prophet. But when he had been at last healed, and he wanted to say thank you, and he had brought all these goods. I think he brought it probably with a different attitude. You know, he's just going to pay the doctor. If he could get some help, well, he'd pay the doctor. But he came saying, "Behold, I thought," you know, when things didn't turn out the way he thought. And then after he said, "Now I know. Behold, I thought, now I know. Behold, I thought you ought to do this and that. Now I know there's no God but in Israel." And then he said, let me give you this. And Elisha said, "No, I don't need it. I want it." And he urged him to take it. I mean, after all, the first time a guy had already shown his lack of materialistic intent by saying, "No, I don't want a thing. The Lord has done this. No sense in the world me sitting down here and taking money for what the Lord himself has done." But, you know, after you've resisted the first time and said, "I don't want it," and he just keeps saying, no, "I want to give this to you. I'm so grateful for what you've done." Then the second time, maybe it'll be a good time to say, "Oh, well, if you insist." But he would not relent. And it's that kind of man who's sitting with his servant. Now, not the same one, but Gehazi has already gotten himself in trouble because he decided he wanted some of that money and clothing and everything that Naaman had. And he goes out and tells all that tale. We don't have time to go into that tonight about how his master really didn't need it for himself. It's all very unselfish, but he needs it for somebody else. All a lie, of course, because Gehazi wanted it for himself. And when this is discovered, known by the prophet, Elisha said, "I saw you when you went out there. I know exactly what you have done." Then he said, the leprosy that has been removed from the body of Naaman is going to attack your own body. And so he became a leper. I don't think that's the same servant that's with Elisha when the Syrians annoyed no end with the fact that he is revealing the secret counsels of their war cabinet to the king of Israel. They decide they'll go get him. He's the enemy. They'll go get him. And so they shut him up. They encompassed the city of Dothan. That's the place where Joseph found his brothers when his father sent him out. It's also a place in Alabama, I guess, but whatever. that's not too significant, but Dothan was the city. Now, it's a city now. Lots happened since the time of Abraham and Jacob. And they've surrounded the city, and his servant said, it's over. We've had it. They've got us here pinned up just like a bird in the cage, and it's over. And Elisha asked the Lord, prayed to the Lord and said, open his eyes that he can see. And the Lord opened his eyes and he saw all around Elisha, angels, the chariots of God surrounding him. Now, we need that same petition, don't we? Open my eyes that I may see. That is the song, one song in our hymn book. Open my eyes that I may see. I have got to understand that the world in which I live tonight has angels in it and fiery chariots. The power and the might of God surrounds us. And I need to know that. I need to know that profoundly, because if I do not know that profoundly, I am going to start being controlled by things. Not just the appeal of material wealth, but the threat of physical illness or the burden of it, which can crush the spirit and make one feel like he's abandoned, or the heartache and disappointment of death of someone we care about, or the betrayal by friends, whatever can happen to you in this life, in this physical world, that can overwhelm you. I'm telling you, lay up for yourselves treasure in heaven. Because that's where your treasure will be, and that's where the strength of your heart will be. And if we don't have that, we're not going to see all those angels when trouble comes. And we will start paying taxes to the devil to try to escape from some physical threat that is really no threat at all. It's good to read the 91st Psalm. You know who quoted from this song? Let me read a little bit of it, and you'll remember maybe. 91st Psalm, verse 11. For he will give his angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways. They shall bear you up in their hands, lest you dash your foot against a stone. You shall tread upon the lion and adder, the young lion and the serpent you shall trample underfoot, because he has set his love upon me, God speaking here. Therefore will I deliver him. I will set him on high because he hath known my name. Yes, you know who quoted that. That was his satanic majesty, the devil, who quoted that to the Lord to try to put him in a bind and a test. But what this is comfort. I mean, you and I are dwelling in a world where angels are. I don't know how fast angels move, but I imagine it's faster than the speed of light. And once you read the scripture, know that he has sent forth his angels, his ministering servants, to do a service on behalf of those that are redeemed, his redeemed people, first chapter of Hebrews at the very end of the chapter. And you begin to see the power of God and understand the power of God, that it's limitless. That he who made the world is able to control it absolutely. Then we quit making our decisions out of fear and terror of a world that is not the source and seat of real power. And we'll not decide how things are going to turn out. Well, guess what happened in Dothan? When they were ruined, I mean, they were caught. There was nothing they could do physically. And that whole army of Syrians were made blind. I don't know what that blindness was. I've thought about that a lot. I wonder if it's a blindness of a confusion. And I don't have the impression that somebody had to lead them out of there. But that he, the prophet Elisha, said to them, this is not the place you want to be. And the man you're looking for is not here. And so he led them. By some means, I don't know whether they're confused or just sort of addled in brain, he led them all the way to Samaria, which was the capital of the kingdom of Israel, and then brought them inside the city, evidently. this army of Syrians, and then by God's power had their blindness dispelled, and there they are looking around. And the king of Israel, being such an astute fellow and as perceptive as he is, said, "Shall I kill them?" He asked it twice. "Shall I rise and kill them?" And Elisha said, "No, you will not touch these men. Would you kill the people you've taken prisoner? They're your prisoners. Feed them and then send them back to their master." Here's something else in this story. Seeing that which is invisible, understanding the power of God, realizing what is around us. Do you realize that when you're sick? Do you realize this when you're brokenhearted? And do you realize that God is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that you ask or think? Do you realize that He can answer your prayers? And that He will answer your prayers? And as the language of the 91st Psalm says, "Because He has looked on me and loved me, I will answer His prayer." That is the promise that's made there. And so, here in this place, Elisha, instead of blowing them away, cutting their heads off, chopping them all up, and sending their bodies back to the king of Syria, he said, "Just send them back home." And the next verse says that the Syrians came no more against them. That's another thing about becoming spiritually minded, is that we have a different understanding of what really works and what has power in this life. We live in a world that says that might is right. That physical force is the thing that gets the job done. And if that doesn't get the job done, you bribe them. I was listening to some program on, I think, public radio, which they were discussing the problem of drugs. And they had some government agent in Colombia out talking to some cocaine farmer. And he said, "But we have always grown this from long ago. We don't need these Americans telling us what to do with our... And besides all that, there's no other way for us to make a living down here." And the fellow kept telling, "But it's killing people." You know, and I didn't mean a thing to the farmer. And finally said, "But the government will pay you a lot of money for not growing cocaine or coca, which makes cocaine." And he said, "Well, a lot of money?" "Oh," he said, "well, we better talk about this." All the other moral arguments failed. Every appeal that he made to him about the problem of drugs and what it's doing to everybody, nothing. And now he says, "But we will pay you a lot of money if you don't do it." And he said, we'll talk about it. And then the drug dealers came in and said, "We'll pay you more money." But the point is, we will be sucked into that sort of thing unless there is some powerful spiritual strength in us. Because we can see the invisible God who hates that. And if God hates it, I'm going to tell you something, it will not work. And it's not going to win anything. You're going to lose. Because He rules in the kingdoms of men. So, what is my relationship to all that surrounds me in the world? What is my reaction to it? What value do I place on it? Do I simply use it for higher purposes, or does it use me because I'm so terrified by it, either because I want to have more of it or I'm afraid I'm going to lose what I've got? What is our salvation to be in all this as we try to make some decisions? 2 Corinthians 5, verse 7, "For we walk by faith and not by sight." And then he says something at the end. He said, "For we must all," verse 10, "stand before the judgment seat of Christ to give account of the things done in the body." I mean, that's an invisible thing, you know. An unseen thing. Judgment? Final judgment? Giving account? Giving account before a God who knows my thoughts almost before I can think them? Who knows my motives as well as my deeds? Who understands my thoughts far off, as the 139th Psalm says? That's an awesome thought. But if I really believe that, I'm telling you, even if I can get away with this low-born thing I'm thinking about, even if I can get away with these lust-driven thoughts, even if I can get away with these dishonest actions, and nobody finds out about it here even, that's a little unlikely perhaps, but let's just say it's going to be that way. But
But what about judgment? What about God?
Now, if the face of God is a very dim and distant figure for me, if this idea of judgment is something that I seldom ever contemplate, and that has no great reality in my mind, I can tell you what I will do. I will satisfy that lust. I'll do that dishonorable thing because God is far away. And that's the reason that many Christians fail. Because their faith has failed. And they're influenced not by the unseen, but by the seen. Walk by faith and not by sight. Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. As I said before, Jesus says the obvious here when he says that you lay up treasures here, you're going to lose them. That's as simple as that, and that ought to be enough. As the man who went down among the Alka Indians years ago, Jim Elliot, and was killed there, his wife says in his diary, he wrote, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." Good statement. And it makes all kinds of sense. But I want to tell you, you've got to use your mind. You've got to think through this thing. And you've got to urgently consider the reality of invisible things because they have to be real by the very nature of the world in which you live and by your own nature. These things have to be real. The evidence for the existence of God is powerful, but if you want to turn off your mind and just feel your way through and respond to what's going on all around you, and it's very, very oppressively present, then of course you're going to lose. You'll become a very physically inclined, carnally minded individual. That's inevitable. So we need our faith. But faith is not based upon some myth or fairy tale. It's based upon the reality of the world in which we live and the nature of ourselves, which point directly to God and to right and wrong and to the importance of doing His will. So we make our investment in heaven, Jesus says. We don't make any investment in this world. And somebody said, "Now, wait just a minute here. I get hungry fairly often, and my spirit may not be interested in fried chicken, but there's some part of me is interested in fried chicken and all that other stuff. What do you mean don't make any investment?" I mean, and Jesus meant, that eat your fried chicken, but remember that when you eat it, you're eating it as unto the Lord and with a view to serving Him in whatever way that gives you strength and energy. It is therefore no longer an investment in this world, is it? But an investment in heaven. And especially if you take your fried chicken and give it to somebody else who needs it more than you do. I feel that sometimes. I know somebody else must need it more than I do because I think I've got a little excess there. So you think about that. Make your investment in heaven even when you're involved in physical things. Let everything be done as unto the Lord in order to serve Him. That's what takes the carnality out of every physical activity. Is you do it for His sake and you give it for His sake. You're doing God's will instead of the will of man. The apostles before the great Sanhedrin, a little intimidating for a bunch of fellows from the backwoods, a lot of them fishermen who are not accustomed to being in the halls of important political figures who tell them that they're not having this preaching anymore in the city of Jerusalem. And they said to them, the fourth chapter of Acts, verse 19, "As to whether or not we ought to obey you, then God, you judge. But we cannot but say and speak the things we've seen and heard." Boldly. They spoke. And I can tell these fellows they're talking to could cut the head off. But think about that. These are real people up here with some real power in a physical sense. And you're going to talk that way to them? Better think. I'm going to say to my boss, "I can't work on that day." I'm going to say that to him. I mean, my livelihood. I know about your livelihood. The Lord knows about your livelihood. What about your life? I'm going to say, "We're having an interesting class. Brother Larry Coffey's leading us through it." I tease him. He says it's a class that has all questions and no answers. But that's not so. He's forcing us to think. about some serious moral issues, and it's good for us. Knock a lot of barnacles off our minds. But, you know, you're going to say to your boss who says to you, I'm not in. Tell him I'm not in. You're going to say, I'm sorry, I cannot do that. And he's got your financial security in a chokehold. And if you lose this job, you may go out and not be able to find it. How do you know you're going to find another job? You have another job? Has somebody told you if anything happens to you at all, I'll give you $1,000 to tide you over right now, and by 1 week you'll have another job? Anybody told you that? No. But I tell you what God has said to you, I will never leave you nor forsake you. And I'll tell you something else. Human beings can tell you that they'll never leave you and forsake you, but they die. Or what they have to give you and would give you if they had it, they lose. But the God who promises he will never leave you is the God who can fulfill his promises because he is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or think, as we've noted before, Ephesians 3, verse 21. And we need to put our hope and trust in him. Obey God, not man. And trust God's power and have confidence in that and not in human wisdom and strength, because it is puny. Is God real to you? Well, we sing this hymn. God is what? God is so real. Well, it's easy enough to sing the hymn, but I ask myself as I sing that hymn, is he real? What does it mean for God to be real to you? God is real to you when what he thinks and what he feels always determines what you think and what you feel. That's when God's real. That's when the song takes on flesh and bone, and flesh. That's when the song gets serious, when I can say I've had decisions to make and I just made them trusting him. Because he's real to me, more real than anything else out here. Where are your treasures? Where are you investing your life? Is it in godliness that we rejoice, or in greed? Paul in 1 Corinthians 6, 6 and following says that godliness with contentment is great gain. Jesus is an interesting study, because Jesus didn't have anything, and Jesus was the most contented, peaceful, confident, secure individual you ever met in all your life, because he knew who he was. He didn't need all these things around him to prove that he was somebody important. He didn't need a lot of sycophants around bowing and scraping to prove that he's who he was. And we don't need it either. We won't let the world tell us when we're beautiful. We want to let the world tell us when we're important. We won't let this culture tell us when we're well-dressed. We want to let them even tell us when we're modestly dressed. Or intelligent or smart. But I tell you, the only one who can really tell you who you are, what you got, is the one that made you and loved you. You talk about self-esteem. That comes from God. Quit listening to television sell you a set of values about how you can be happy, be young, be rich, and be pretty, handsome. And listen to God. Jesus calls us out of this culture. He's saying to us, get out of this world. He doesn't mean commit suicide. He's meaning you quit listening to this nonsense. First of all, because it is obviously and manifestly nonsense. But secondly, because I am telling you that that's the case of it. I speak out of the voice of God himself, because God in all his fullness is in me. And I'm speaking to you out of the wisdom that is limitless, that comes out of God. And I'm telling you that this is not the way. So, if you keep on following the world, you'll never find life. You'll just keep chasing it all your life. And it'll never come to anything. God knows that you have need of food. Isn't that what Jesus goes on to say? God knows about that. He knows you need to have a place to stay. Knows you need clothing. Well, let me tell you about that. You know this already. How many suits of clothes can you wear at the same time? Well, I've seen some people a little strange wearing several suits of clothes at the same time. And I've seen it at the circus when the clowns do their thing. But I never saw any human being that had any sense about it that'd be wearing several at the same time. Just one. That's all you can wear. Oh, but I want to be sure I got one in the closet back there. Oh, you can't wear it now. In the closet? No, you can't wear it now. And how many spaces can you occupy at one time? How many houses can you live in? Well, I guess maybe a little more than that to walk around. I need a little exercise, but there's not too much space I absolutely need to survive. And how much food? How many meals can you eat at the same time? Some of us, maybe it'd be dangerous to ask that question. Because every meal is a challenge to see how much we can put away, but only so much. And we need having food and raiment, Paul says in 1 Timothy 6, having food and raiment, be there with content. Because I'll tell you something, to be content is a precious thing. It's happiness, fulfillment, completeness. And only God can give that to you. And it only comes to you when godliness is the most important thing in your life. Your character is more important than the thing. Your character, who you are, is more important than what you have. And so keep that in mind. Don't deify things. Don't be intimidated and bulldozed by this world. It's all around you. It is so tangible. This young lady that's not the one I ought to be having anything to do with because she's not spiritual, but she's so beautiful. I know she's not, yes, there's not hardly a spiritual bone there, but she is so, she looks so good. And this young man, I know that he's wild, and I know that he doesn't seem to have a lot of moral principle, but he is so good looking. Ooh! And he's so real and so present. I know all those things are there, but you don't listen to that. You remember God, who you are, this spiritual individual with this high calling. You don't want to run around with the trash. I don't mean that in an untoward way. I don't want to reduce human beings that way, but look, you've been called to something high. And now the conclusion. Philosophers often use the term beatitude to refer to a time when a human being has a larger-than-life vision of what life is and means. Webster's Collegiate Dictionary of the 1949 edition, which will tell you when I was a freshman in college, I needed a new dictionary. You don't need to think about that on my birthday, because I'll have one before then. I've been thinking about it a long time, and I think it's time to act. The back's coming off of that old dictionary. Not only that, but the interesting thing is the young men I work with down here, they didn't even have one from 1949. They keep coming in borrowing my 1949 collegiate. But it's out of date. But it says consummate bliss and blessedness. And you know, here we are tonight, and we're sitting with beatitude. It's times like this when we're together. And we sing these hymns, and Ben led us in hymns tonight about heaven, that we have a sense of completeness and blessing and reality. We feel the connection with that other true world, though it's unseen. We are here, it is true, but we are far more truly there. We don't love this world. We love that one. And that is the essence of being a Christian. And ain't it wonderful? We are not animals. And we're not angels. But we're made a little lower than angels. so that we can live in the world where our Father lives, who is the Father of our spirits, who loves us and is calling us to come by faith to live with Him forever. If you are not a Christian, think about this. And ask yourself just exactly what you have in mind for the future. And open your eyes or close your eyes and see the truth that not only He exists, but He's the reward of those that diligently seek Him. And the true life for a human being is spiritual. And the only place to put your treasure is in heaven. And the way to do that is to serve God all the days of your life. You can come tonight and confess your faith in Jesus. I am persuaded that you believe. And now you just have to act upon that. Don't get bulldozed by this world. But act upon that reality you know is so. And believing, obey His will. By beginning in that act of faith which consummates you're coming to Him to be baptized in His name for the forgiveness of sins, and then ever afterward live a life seeing that which is invisible, but which is also eternal. While we encourage you by standing and singing.